trying to think of some of the books out there that I find are pretty special. I mentioned some of them to you already. The book called The Lie is one of my favorite titles. It would take an Australian to put that kind of a name on a book. The Australians are really blunt. I mean, you know, Australians get a big kick out of us, like Ken Ham. We go into a restaurant, you know, and the waitress or waiter will say, you know, how was the food? And he always says, every American just say, fine. He doesn't even care if they feed you garbage. You know, they say, how's the food? You say, fine. In Australia, hey, if the food wasn't good, you think, boy, it was terrible. You just tell them straight away. And he wrote this book, and it's about evolution, and it's titled The Lie. Not real subtle. And the thing that's interesting about that book is it deals more with what are the religious implications for the Christian. You know, sort of like the last talk I gave is covered there. And a lot of excellent books out there, some excellent children's books. They were not available just 10, 12 years ago. There were no creation books for kids that I can recall. Boy, has that gap been filled. I mean, there's so many excellent books on all kinds of subjects, dinosaurs and fossils and books on weather and geology and gold mine of books, a chance to pick up books for grandkids, for presents and things that you don't have to worry about anybody else buying for them unless they hang around AIG too. Good chance to load up for the grandkids and cousins and what have you with good material. Lots of videos that I think you'll enjoy. This particular talk that I'm giving you is a video out there. It's called The Hearing Ear and the Seeing Eye. Boy, am I glad Ken Ham isn't here to introduce me on this. Normally I speak with Ken, and he always likes to introduce his talk. And he says, and now Dr. Manton's going to talk about the hearing eye and the seeing ear. Yeah, real miracle. So the other thing I'd like to mention, it's something new that AIG is just getting involved with now. We, in the past, sold a magazine that was actually printed in Australia called Creation Magazine. It's an excellent magazine. It's still available there. But AIG has been planning for some time to just do their own magazine here in the States, more geared towards the U.S. audience. We'll have a separate version of it sold in the U.K. that will be geared to the U.K. audience. But I think it's a little bit more accessible to the average family, a little less technical, a little bit more general, and it's going to stretch out a little bit further than just strictly creation. It's going to also cover some of the worldview implications that go along with evolution and creation. And boy, I'll tell you, they've got some fabulous artists. You look at the layout on this magazine, it is pro. Well, like everything that AIG does, it's just top quality. And I'm not taking anything away from Creation Magazine. It's a wonderful magazine. I think it fills a separate niche. It'd be good to have both. But you might consider the first issue will be just coming out now within the month. And it'll be a quarterly, and eventually it'll be a bi-monthly, you know, every 2 months. But it's called Answers Magazine. And there are order blanks out there. And boy, I'll tell you, if you're disappointed with Answers Magazine, I'd sure like to hear it, because they have put a lot of effort into it. It's going to... We have sold more Answers magazines before it's even published than we ever sold Creation magazines when we actually had a magazine to give people. So it's really caught the imagination of folks, and it's meeting a niche. It has a whole pullout section for children, which features Buddy Davis, you know, and all of the neat things he does. And that slides out so the kids have their own little issue. The graphics and the art and the... Everything's just going to be spectacular. So if you have an interest in that kind of magazine, you might want to just sign up and get on the subscription list. That's what I was thinking, prescription. And be a charter subscriber and get the first issue. It might be kind of fun to have the first issue of a magazine that I know is going to be big. So that's your tip. Answers Magazine. You can find the subscription form out there, and you can see flyer showing you what the first issue will look like. And the first issue is done. I mean, it's being printed now, so this is not pie in the sky. This is rolling. Okay, that being said, we're going to talk about then the hearing ear and the seeing eye. As I mentioned before, you know, the scriptures really don't say anything about the spleen. It doesn't say God made the spleen. It doesn't say anything about the pituitary or the prostate, or as everybody's Aunt Harriet calls it, the prostrate gland. We know that God made those things too. How do we know that? Because, you know, you look in the book of John. John 1 says right away that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And without him, nothing was made that was made. So God made everything. But he does not want you to ever get confused about the ear and the eye. He just puts it on the line straight away and says, you see that? I made it. And I've often wondered, why did he single out those two organs? Well, certainly they were well understood. Maybe people didn't know about the prostate back then. The Lord did, but the average person didn't, so they'd have been a little confused. But you have to admit, the ear and the eye are very special, because these are the organs by which we are communicated with God. This is how we see his handiwork in nature. This is how we read his scripture. This is how we hear his word. These wonderful organs are our mechanism for being communicated with by God, who's chosen to communicate with us through his word. So Proverbs 20, verse 12, that's where we get the title. I always like to have a Bible verse be the title of my lectures. And, you know, a lot of people don't want to believe that God created the ear and the eye, and I've often wondered, why don't they want to believe it? And I think this verse tells you why folks really don't want to believe, a lot of people don't want to believe that God created the ear and the eye. Psalm 94, verse 9, this is worth some thought here. It says, he that planted the ear, shall he not hear? Oh my goodness, somebody who could create the ear, how well do you think they would hear? The creator of the ear could hear your thoughts. And he that formed the eye, shall he not see? How well do you think the creator of the eye can see? He can see into your hearts. I got a question for you. Can you afford to have such a creator? Can you afford to have the creator of heaven and earth, the great Jehovah God, hear your thoughts and see into your hearts? To see every move you make, to see through every lie we tell, every fib, every devious effort, every bit of self-justification. Remember, this is the God who says, you shall be perfect as I, the Lord thy God, am perfect. No wonder people don't want to believe in creation. I think we get the idea sometimes, I'll go out and give a lecture, just going to beat people over the head why they can't help but believe in a creator when I get done. In fact, I've had people come up after some of my lectures and said, I wish you could talk to my Uncle Harry. Now, if we have any Uncle Harrys here, I'm sorry, I don't mean anything negative about Uncle Harry's. This is a fictitious name that I pulled out here. They come up and say, I wish you could talk to my Uncle Harry. He hates God, he hates Christians, he hates the Bible. All he talks about is evolution. Boy, you'd put him in his place. And I always have to tell him, no, you know, I don't think I would. I don't think the Lord's going to give me enough years left in my life to argue with your Uncle Harry until he changes his mind. He has a spiritual problem, you see. The more I would tell Uncle Harry about the marvelous beauty of the way the ear is constructed in the eye, the more frightened he'd get, because creation, when you think about it, is really the law. And the law convicts. And when people know there's a God who created the ear, they are convicted. And a God who created the eye, they're convicted. Now, that's good. We have to teach the law first, don't we? It's only when people have the law that they then can understand the need for the gospel. But I think sometimes people get the cart before the horse. They think that maybe you can convert somebody just by beating them over the head with scientific evidence. And I've never been able to do it. And you know, I can talk about as fast as anyone. I had a lab tech that worked in my lab for 5 years. And she was an unbeliever. And during about every break we took, I'd try to share the word of God with her. At least talk about creation and evolution. Well, after 5 years, I had utterly destroyed her confidence in evolution. She agreed it was hogwash, but she didn't become a Christian. She thought, that's too much. I can't go there. She could see evolution didn't work. So it really, in the end, still takes the word of God and the Holy Spirit to change the heart. And I believe that if you don't have a Savior, you can't afford to have a creator. It's too frightening. It's too frightening. Well, those of us who are believers, it's fun to know. It's delightful to know that the Lord who created the eye can see and the Lord who created the ear can hear. Look at this. Is this not wonderful for the Christian? The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, the ones made righteous by the redemptive work of Christ himself. And the ears of God are open to our cry. You see how different it is? You see how easy creation comes for the believer? Because we want the Lord's ears to be open to our cry. We want the Lord's eyes to be on our righteousness, which he gives us. But the unbeliever is intimidated and terrified by such things. And so they need to finally get the whole counsel of God. Well, let's dig into the hearing ear. Pretty amazing organ, as you all know. I guess everybody's able to hear what I have to say right now. Some people have lost that particular blessing of hearing. I've lost a good bit of it over the years myself, but I'm still hearing pretty well. What is it exactly we hear? Well, of course, we hear sound. And sound is interesting. When I speak, if I didn't have a microphone here, what you'd be hearing is I have a couple of vocal cords in there, and they're doing this. These little cords are going back and forth. And what they're doing is they're compressing air. When they go together, they compress a little air. When they go apart, there's kind of a little vacuum or partial less pressure. So more pressure, less pressure, more pressure, less pressure. And so this pressurized air is going out, but nothing is really passing from me to you. No object is leaving my vocal cords, going through the ear and hitting your ear. What's happening is this. Have you ever lined up marbles or billiard balls in a row touching one another? And then if you hit with a shooter ball, the one on the end, when it hits that row, almost none of the balls move except the one at the far end, and that one will take off and roll. What's happening is energy is being passed from ball to ball to ball to ball, and then the last one takes off. That's the way sound moves. One molecule hits the next molecule. One little pulse of pressure hits the next, and so no molecule travels the whole distance, but the effect of that pressure change goes from me to you. This little picture shows a bell. And as the bell rings, you can see here's less air pressure, here's more air pressure. Here's less, here's more, here's less. And it's a kind of a bucket brigade thing. It passes the energy on to the next until it gets to the eardrum, and then the eardrum is able to hear it. What kind of pressure are we talking about here? You all know about air pressure. You know, for example, when you go up in a mountain, is the air pressure less on a high mountain or higher? It's less. Harder to breathe up there. And so we might be interested, since we're hearing air pressure, what kind of differential in air pressure are we able to hear? You know, high versus low. Well, this is going to impress the daylights out of you. You can see right there, our ear is sensitive to a change in pressure of 1 times 10 to the minus 10 atmospheres. Is that incredible or what? I don't think anybody here is particularly impressed. We don't know what an atmosphere is. Okay, well, I didn't either until I looked it up. I looked it up before you got to it, so I'll explain it. An atmosphere is the pressure of air at sea level. So what? We're a little above sea level here, I suppose, in our fair city. And so we're a little less than one atmosphere here. Give you an idea. If you've ever been to Mount Evans in Colorado, that's the highest highway in the world that you can actually drive up in a car. So if you're going to do it by car, that's as high as you can get. It's 14,260 feet high, and when you're that high, that's a half atmosphere. Now, I got a question for you. How high a mountain would you have to climb to experience 1 times 10 to the minus 10 atmospheres? Because that's the difference in air pressure your ear is able to hear at the rate of 20,000 times per second, at least when you're young. It turns out that that mountain is not very high. It's comparable to increasing your altitude or decreasing it by 1/30,000th of an inch, which happens to be the thickness of this thick piece of paper. So I'm going to demonstrate. I'm going to put this on the floor. And now I am going to climb up on top of the paper. I am not as young as I used to be, but I'm going to try it, because when I'm up there, that'll be the difference in pressure. Okay, here we go. You know, the air is a little thinner up here. I can see you don't believe anything I'm telling you, so I might as well get back to my lecture. But that's it. That much difference. That's what you're hearing. Thousands of times a second. That kind of difference in pressure. Top of the paper, off the paper, and top of the paper. That's what's going on. Is that ear great or what? But you haven't heard anything yet. You probably think the ear is really complicated. As it turns out, it only has three parts. Three major parts, actually three areas. The first part is being indicated there. It would include the ear itself, which, so we don't confuse it with the whole thing we call the ear, we can call this the auricle. And then there's a hole going in the side of the head. I'm not getting too technical, am I? No, I didn't think so. There's a hole going in the side of the head, external auditory canal. And this part is filled with air. Does that make sense? Air out here, air in here. And so we hear through air because we live in air. So the sound gets transported through air, these little pulses of pressure. So the next part of the ear that's in the middle of the ear has been given a really creative name. It's called the middle ear. The outer ear is called the outer ear. I'm not going too fast. I didn't think so. No. So that's the middle ear. And the middle ear does not hear through air. It hears through bone. So the sound goes through vibrating bone. And then you've got the inner ear. Can anyone guess what we call the inner ear? The inner ear. Yeah, you thought anatomy was going to be complicated. The inner ear does not hear through air. It does not hear through bone. The inner ear hears through liquid, basically like water. So you got the picture. We're going through three completely separate substances: air, bone, liquid. Why? Well, we live in air. So naturally, you're going to hear through air. So that takes care of the outer ear. The cells in here are bare cells. They're just exposed. And they would not survive if they were exposed to air. They have to be exposed to a fluid that's nice and warm and has just the right pH and just the right salt concentration. And so this is a liquid in here. So the sound has to go from the air to the liquid. And it does so through this little intermediate range called the middle ear. We'll get into why this is also in a bit. Let's start with the outer ear. The outer ear includes the auricle, which is this flap out here we talked about. It includes the external auditory canal, which is fancy for the ear hole. And then it includes my favorite substance. This is wonderful. Do I have an hour to talk about earwax? Stick with the lecture. Okay. Oh, there's two things I love to talk about. One is earwax and the other is mucus. I could do my mucus lecture now if you wanted. No, stick to the ear and the... Okay, let's stick. Now, one of the things that evolutionists tell us is that, you know, you can see right away that their evolution must be true because our ear is attached to three muscles. The external... auricle here, and there's one muscle that pulls the auricle forward, there's one that pulls it up, and there's one that pulls it back, and who really needs to move their ear around like that? And they say this is left over from our evolutionary ancestors, like, say, rabbits that can take their ears and aim them all different directions. Now, I've met people who can literally move their ear about a bit. Most of us can under conditions that maybe aren't entirely voluntary. Maybe when we yawn, our ears move a little bit or something like that. But evolutionists say, well, see, there you go. What good are these muscles except for to remind us of our evolutionary ancestors? Well, it turns out that the auricle does have some important functions in channeling sound and gathering it. It helps us to tell whether sound's in front of us or behind us. And maybe small movements are involved in being able to hear better. But, you know, when you think about it, not only are those muscles difficult to understand, but really almost all of the facial muscles here are as well. What are any of these muscles doing? You see this muscle here? Its function is to grimace. Would life go on if you couldn't grimace? Did people who could grimace leave more offspring than those who couldn't grimace? This one's nice. This is a wrinkle your nose muscle. There is a furrow your eyebrow muscle. There is a shaving muscle down here for shaving. You do this and you shave. I guess my favorite is the one right on the end here I call it the Kirk Douglas muscle. It wrinkles your chin, puts a little dimple in it. There's actually a lesson here. Notice that there are four muscles here that attach to the angle of the mouth. This one, and this one. And when these four muscles or any one of them contract, we smile. And there's only one muscle, this one, that is the sadness muscle that makes our mouth droop. There's a lesson there. Four for smiling, one for sadness. Let's try to keep that ratio in mind in life, shall we? And only one for grimacing. Of all these facial muscles, there's only two that really need to be there. This one around the mouth is necessary for the baby to suckle, necessary to do this. If we didn't have that muscle and we tried to drink water, it would all pour down our chin. Baby couldn't suckle. And this one around the eye, oh, they all have really horrendous scientific names, your orbicularis oculi, the orbicularis oris, but you know what I mean here. This muscle is important because without this muscle, you really couldn't close your eyelids. You could open them, but you couldn't close them. And you know, sometimes when babies are delivered with forceps, they get a hold of the head here and they pull, the nerves that supply these facial muscles come out right behind the ear. If you feel back here, you got a bump back here. It's called a mastoid process. And in a baby, that bone is not there. That bone develops from the muscle that pulls on it. That's the one that makes the ridge going down here. Okay. And when the baby starts to lift its head, you know, it's pulling on its attachment, this bone, from here down to our basically clavicle and sternum here. Muscle's called a sternocleidomastoid. It goes from the sternum and clavicle to the mastoid. And it's the pulling that makes that bone well up. And you already learned that's a piezoelectric phenomenon that's generating electrical currents. It's remodeling the bone to optimize the pull of the muscle. Is this great or what? It's dynamic. It's alive. And when the baby's born, you don't have that bone there because you haven't been pulling on your head to lift your head. And so that nerve is very vulnerable. Now it's covered by this bone. And so forceps can pinch it. And if it pinches it, it can destroy the nerves to the facial muscles. The babies can't suckle, and they can't close their eyelids, and they'll actually stitch the eyelids closed until they can get the nerve hooked up again to prevent the possibility of going blind from not being able to close the eye. But the nerve can regenerate and grow. So we can see these muscles are to give us an alive face. Everything, forehead, cheek, ears, our whole face is alive. As a result, you can tell when people are putting you on, can't you? Just look at them. You can tell when people are fibbing. You can tell when they're embarrassed. You can tell when they're lying. It's hard to put your finger. You just look at their face. We really, there is no other animal that communicates this way. Monkeys, if you've seen them, they have a kind of a stereotype grimace and, like this, and then they turn it off again. But you can't tell when a monkey's putting you on and fibbing. You can't tell when they're smirking. You can't tell when they're being insincere. You can't tell when they're embarrassed at what they just did. Now, my wife thinks our dog has facial expressions. She's quite a dog lover. He's an Australian Shepherd. He's a very smart dog. But she'll say, look at Kadar. Doesn't he look embarrassed? Now look at him. It's the same old dog face. Nothing's changed. So anyway, we have that. Darwin was very interested in the oracle. He saw all kinds of evolution in it, naturally. Here's the oracle here. And there's a little bump up there, right there. It's called Darwin's tubercle. If you feel on the inner margin of your ear, right at that point where we're pointing, you might feel a little tiny, almost sharp bump there. Can you feel that? You probably didn't know it was there until now. You didn't know it was Darwin's tubercle, and you probably didn't know what the evolutionary significance of that little bump is. Darwin was actually able to figure out that this little bump is left over from our evolutionary ancestors that had floppy ears. Yeah, you can teach this in the public school, just you can't criticize it, that's all. You can't credit. You can teach it, but you can't criticize it. And you're probably having a hard time imagining what such an ancestor would have looked like. Well, I just brought my dog Kadar along here to show you. So here's the floppy ear. Do I have an hour to talk about my dog? This is an incredible dog. He does impersonations. He does the seven dwarfs. You tell him to do sneezy, he sneezes. You tell him to do sleepy, he falls down and looks like he's sleeping. You tell him to do bashful, he puts his paw over the... I mean, he's an amazing dog. The only thing I don't like about him is he's smarter than I am, and that's embarrassing. But I digress. Let's look at the rest of the outer ear. This is this canal coming in. The artist has made it too big in diameter. It's actually only a third of an inch in diameter and 1 inch long, and it's tuned like an organ pipe to have the optimum resonant frequency to hear sound in the range of human speech. So the length diameter is like tuning a pipe on an organ for resonant frequency. The other thing, and as far as I'm concerned, this alone shows that there is a God. The ear canal is a third of an inch in diameter, but your finger is about a half inch in diameter. So you cannot get your finger in the ear canal. Imagine if this were not so. You would say to your young son, who rarely listens to anything you say, Algernon, whatever you do, do not put your finger in your ear. You'll punch your eardrum out. What's the next thing Algernon's going to do? Right in the ear. There goes the eardrum. The Lord knew that he was going to be that way, so he just, rather than fight with him, just made sure the finger is bigger than the ear canal. And this worked till the advent of Q-tips, but that's another whole issue. Lining the ear canal are glands that produce earwax. Oh, earwax is incredible. We know that, for example, if the glands that make it, here are the glands here, if they can't make earwax, you get all kinds of inflammation and problems with your ears. So it's necessary to kind of seal that skin. The other thing that's neat about earwax, have you seen these things, that sharper image cells and what have you, the electrostatic air filters? They're supposed to get all the dust out of the air at electrostatic attraction. Would you believe the Lord put electrostatic air filters in your ear? The wax, as it turns out, is an unusual wax. It's a filamentous wax that has electrostatic properties that attracts and traps dust. Well, now that's a nice idea, except now that you trapped it, what do you plan on doing with it? Isn't this true of filters? I mean, they filter, but then sooner or later you have to change the filter or whatever. You think the Lord doesn't know about these things? Of course, it's all figured out. The wax is going to keep filling in the ear. In fact, this is lined with skin, and the skin's going to continue to grow after all. It turns over the whole epidermis every month. So you keep turning over all this skin, you keep making all this wax, and pretty soon your ear canal is just totally plugged with dead cells and wax. But, as evolutionists would tell you, thanks to an incredible stroke of dumb luck, or, if you're a Christian, thanks to the sovereign care of God, this is the only place in the body where the skin, instead of growing up like an elevator, grows sideways, like a people mover in an airport. So the wax is constantly being brought out of the ear canal, out where you can get at it. Is this a nice touch or what? Let's look at that. Here's the ear canal. Here's the eardrum. Some years ago, somebody studied this. They thought, you know, how does this work? How fast does it go and what have you? So they put little markers in, like little pieces of black carbon, and they put it on the eardrum, and then they looked in with one of those little otoscopes that the doctors use to see what happened. And I'm going to show you. Everything moves, starting from the center of the eardrum to the edge, and then it spirals on out of the canal. It follows a pattern like this. Watch. To the edge and then out. And it keeps pulling it out. Now, some people, the conveyor doesn't work, and then they have to go in about once a year or so and get their ears cleaned out. But if it works, it's all automatic. Man alive, everywhere you look, the Lord's hand is there. You know, people say they don't believe that the body shows any evidence of design. Everybody's forbidden in the public schools now to even mention the word design. I'll tell you, I've gotten to the point where I don't even take people seriously anymore that say they don't see any evidence for design in the body. If they did, I'd lose all respect for them and couldn't even talk to them. So I just thank God that in Romans chapter 1, he says, they suppress the truth and unrighteousness. So I can rest assured they're not stupid. They know just as well as I do that there's a creator. It's just that the implications are so dreadful and frightening that they suppress the truth. So until they come to understand the gospel, which is only through the Word and the Holy Spirit, I don't blame them for being afraid. I would too. I would run as far as I could run from this Creator if I didn't have a Savior. Well, that's the external auditory canal. Let's look at the external ear. Let's look at the middle ear. where we have bone. Why do we go from air to bone if we're on our way to water? Why not just go from air right to the water? Well, there's a good reason for that. You ever try to talk to somebody who is underwater? You're above water, like in a swimming pool, and maybe Algernon. I mean, the kid's always getting into trouble. He's underwater in the pool, and he's grabbing his sister's leg, who's convinced he's a shark. And she's going nonlinear. And you're yelling down to Algernon to quit doing that. And, of course, he doesn't hear you. Not that he would anyway, but he doesn't hear you. The reason he doesn't hear you is because there is an impedance mismatch between air and water. What does that mean? That means that the sound energy going through the pulses of air, when it hits the water, 99.9% of that energy gets reflected off the water and comes right back again. 0.1% goes in the water. Hey, Algernon is not responding for 0.1%. So we cannot hear things outside the water very well when we're underwater. The Lord's aware of the problem. So what has to be done is you have to have a mechanism to restore the impedance mismatch between air and liquid. And that's exactly what these bones do. There are three of them in succession, all attached by lubricating hinges. And when the sound hits the eardrum wiggles. That wiggles the bones. That in turn goes to a little piston that pushes in and out on the liquid. And you restore almost all of the energy loss that you would normally have. So that's the whole function of the middle ear, to get the impedance match back that you lost going from air to water. Let's look at those bones and that eardrum. This is an amazing story here. Here's the eardrum right here. And this eardrum is skin. It has blood vessels in it. It has nerves, as you know. It can be very painful. You get a perforated eardrum or whatever. And there's some really amazing facts about the eardrum and those little bones. First of all, our hearing sensitivity range is amazing. The ratio of the loudest sound to the quietest sound is 1,000,000 to 1. That would be like comparing the quietest whisper that you can hear to a really loud sound, like putting your ear right next to a jet aircraft engine wound up at full level, or even worse, a rock band. And we are able to accommodate this incredible range of sound. Now, what's really amazing is how much does the eardrum have to move for us to hear sound? Because it's just the air bouncing off the head of the eardrum. At the range of human speech, about 4 kilohertz, 4,000 cycles per second, the eardrum is able to respond to movements of 1/10 the diameter of a hydrogen atom. How about that for a creator, huh? Now, I know you're impressed. 1/10 of a hydrogen atom. This is way below anything you could ever see with any kind of electron microscope or anything of the kind. It's impossible to even imagine 1/10 of a hydrogen atom. But you know, you don't know the half of it yet. While you are hearing 1/10 of a hydrogen atom movement, inside the eardrum are blood vessels with red blood cells carrying these cells through that are shaking the living daylights out of the eardrum. So the eardrum is going like this while you're hearing little taps on it. The noise filtration going on in the brain is amazing. We should be driven insane by the volume of our own blood supply to our eardrum. Instead, we don't hear that. We hear 1/10 of a hydrogen atom diameter movements. What kind of a creator do we have? You can see why. I've just reached the point in my life now, maybe it just comes with older age or whatever, but I've just come to let God be God. Whatever he says is fine with me. You know, he says he put all the animals in a really large boat. And that's nice. I guess I'm glad he picked a really large boat and everything to do it. But you know, if the Lord would have put all those animals in a teacup, that'd be just fine with me if that's what he said he did. I'm just willing to let God be God because he's got me so snowed with everything he's done. I mean, I can't begin to follow him. I just sit back and just get bowled over with amazement. And the more I learn, and I love to learn more, people say, well, if you just say God did it, you're never going to want to learn more. That's ridiculous. That's like saying if you know there's a brilliant engineer at the Canon company that's designing cameras, you're not going to want to know any more about the camera. You're going to want to know more about it than if it was just a result of some random accident at the factory. Right? you're going to be more interested if you know there's a brilliant designer behind it than you are than if it was just a simply a chaotic jazz dance of the molecules, as Huxley once called it. Well, those little bones are tiny. The littlest bone in the whole body is this one right here. These three bones in succession, this one here is called the hammer. It actually, the handle of the hammer attaches to the drum head. And then there's a sealed and lubricated joint, and the lube is all automatic. You don't have any grease circs on this thing. You don't have to go in there and have it relubed. It's all automatic. And it's a tiny little sealed joint. And this is on an axle, so the hammer is doing this. Not the whole thing moving, but it's kind of rotating. And then the next thing is called the anvil. Sort of fancifully looks like an anvil. And it's on an axle, so it's rocking too. So the two are kind of doing this. And then this end of the anvil down here, it's kind of a long stick, is attached by a lubricated joint to a little bone that looks exactly like a stirrup on a saddle. And it's been given a really creative name. It's called the stirrup. I can't believe how you're all worried, thinking this was going to be like a really complicated talk. And what happens, this handle goes back and forth like this, and that pushes the stirrup foot plate in and out of an oval-shaped hole that's been given a really creative name, the oval hole or window. Mm-hmm. And in here's the liquid. Now, right away, you can see there's a problem. You ever have a soda bottle that's full of water, right? Then you take a cork. Can you push the cork in if the soda bottle's full of water? No, because water's incompressible. So how is the little foot plate going to go in and out to push on this liquid? Simple. What you do is you take the Coke bottle or the soda bottle, you cut the bottom off and put a little round rubber head on it. So when you push the piston in, that pouches out. Does that make sense? It's a little relief thing. And so you have an oval window here, and down here is a round one that's been given the creative name round window. And it has like a little rubber diaphragm, so when you push in here, the round window pushes out down here. That's how you're able to kind of change the flow of fluid in there. Okay, this little bone weighs 1/10,000th of an ounce, this little stapes. I'll show you the size of these bones. They're really tiny. Look at the size of the forefinger and thumb, and here are the three little bones from the middle ear. And these are the only bones in your body that never grow. When a baby's born, they're the full size. They never get bigger. I mean, this is it. And what attaches to bones? Bones are levers, basically, aren't they? Usually there are muscles attached to bones. And so it won't come as a huge surprise when I tell you the littlest muscle in the body, a couple of the littlest ones are attached to these bones. And the littlest one is attached to the stapes, which is fancy for stirrup, and it's called a stapedius. Okay, I'll show you these muscles. They're kind of interesting. This one's called the tensor tympani, and it attaches to the handle of the hammer and the drum head. And it gets its name from, you ever watch the tympani player? When they play the tympani and they want the sound to quit, they put their hand on it, don't they? They dampen the drum head. That's what this thing does. It dampens the drum head. And then there's another little muscle down here. You can't even see it. This is so tiny. It's called a stapedius. That dampens the stirrup. And between the two, they dampen down the vibration of these little bones. And why did they do that? Because the Lord knew there would be people come up behind you with a big pair of cymbals. When they get behind you, they go, like, don't you hate it when people do that? The Lord knew there would be idiots like that. And so what these muscles do, before you hear the cymbals, they dampen the system down so it doesn't overload. It's a reflex. Is this great or what? I mean, what kind of a God do we have to do something like that? It also modulates our hearing by dampening those bones. Well, let's go to the inner ear. This is the most amazing of all. This is where the fluid is. And if we magnify that, this part that have semicircular canals here, which are called the semicircular canals, are involved with your whole sense of orientation in space, whether you're this way, or that way. There's a little fluid in there. We won't talk about that anymore. Here's the oval window that the footplate goes in. Here's a round window with a little rubber diaphragm that punches out. And then there's this thing that's shaped exactly like what? A snail. And it has been called the snail. But, of course, they have to use a Latin name, so they call it the cochlea, which means snail. But if we just called it snail, you'd all understand. But by giving it a Latin name like cochlea, and I say, ah, and this is the cochlea, you think, what a genius. He's able to say these Latin words. What a shame to cover such a brain with hair. It ought to be out in the open where we can see it with chrome parts like a race car engine or something. Now, there's a liquid in here, and when you push in here and it comes out there, this liquid kind of goes this way and that way. You got the picture? It goes around the little snail. Let's look inside the snail. See, that's the pressure going in. This is the pressure coming out. And if we look inside, kind of saw it in two here, you can see the pressure goes in. It goes round and round and round to the top, goes through a little hole, and comes back down again. And there's two different chambers, an upper and a lower one. So it goes in one, comes back the other. And then in between these two chambers is a third triangular-shaped chamber that goes all the way around. And in this chamber is simply the most marvelous organ in the body. It's called the organ of Corti, named after Corti. I wish I would have discovered it. It would have been called the organ of Menten. Let's look at that one turn of the snail shell. The pressure goes in, this is all liquid, remember, goes in here, and then it comes out here. And so first the pressure's higher here, and then the pressure's higher down there, right? Kind of goes from side to side. And when it does this, this little triangular region, which is also full of liquid, hops up and down. You can see why it would. Pressure's high on top, down. Pressure's high on the bottom, up. And it goes up and down. And when it goes up and down, you have to think 3D now. This is going in a spiral. This little structure, which you're just seeing in cross-section, is actually a long strip spiraling in there. And this little structure is hopping up and down. That makes sense? It would hop up and down with the pressure. Okay, let's look at that at a higher power. Here it is. It has this membrane called the tectorial membrane, which is a long strip. We're just seeing it in cross-section. And below it are little cells that have little hairs on them. And these cells with the hairs have been given a very creative name. They're called the hair cells. There's three outer ones and one inner one. So these are the outer hair cells, the inner hair cell. They have little nerves coming up to them. They're what sense the sound. See, the way it works is this. As this thing hops up and down, these little hairs, which are really cilia, they're much smaller than a hair. They're like the little cilia in your respiratory tree, except these are not motile. And this is what happens. Think of the purple thing as being like my hand, only it'd be real broad, a long strip. And the green and the hair cells would be my fist. The hairs are sticking up here, right? And we put this on top. Now, if I go up and down, keeping my elbows anchored, do you see how the hand will just naturally slip on top? And that wiggles the hairs. And it's the wiggling of the hairs that generates electric current that goes to the brain that gets interpreted as Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. So let's look at this. This is, oh, so gorgeous. We took the purple layer off. We took the tectorial membrane off. So now you can see the hair cells lined up. Remember, they're a long strip. We were just looking at a cross-section before. These are the three outer hair cells. This is the inner hair cells. Let's crank up the power. Call this magnifying the Lord. Here's the three outer hair cells. These are the inner cells. Here you can see the hairs. This is an electron microscope. You need this kind of power to see these. Let's crank it up some more. That's what the outer hair cells look like. This is the inner. And now you see that the hairs are in ranks like organ pipes. You get shorter ones and the next taller ones and the next taller ones. You're probably wondering, why do they do that? They have the little ranks like that. Oh, this is so amazing. I should charge you $25 a piece to learn the next fact about these things. Well, here's the way it works. Here's a hair cell. Here are the hair cells that are in rank, or the hairs that are in ranks. Here's a longer hair and a shorter hair, right? It turns out that on the end of each of these hairs, it requires an electron microscope to see the hair, is a trap door made out of a molecule. The trap door has a hinge and covers an opening. Here you can see it magnified, this little molecular opening. Here is the trapdoor that can open and close, and this is an ion channel. It emits electrically charged ions in and out of the hair. The way the sound works is as the tectorial membrane hops, or makes these, wiggles these hairs, hops up and down, wiggles the hairs, the two hairs moving in relationship to one another, like this, the longer hair, so help me, has a molecular spring, shown here, a spring made out of a molecule, that goes from the longer hair to the tip of the shorter hair. See it here? Now, the electrical, the spring is attached to a bracket on the longer hair, and the bracket is not fixed. It slides up and down on the longer hair by means of little oars, like in a boat, that row real quick and cause the bracket to go up and down, which in turn adjusts the tension on the spring, which in turn adjusts the speed at which the molecular trapdoor can open and close, which must be to the highest frequency a young person is able to hear, which is about 20,000 times per second. And it is the electrical ions going into the tip of the hair that then trigger the nerves that go to the brain and get interpreted as a mighty fortress is our God. That's what kind of God we have. That's so amazing. You know, I don't even want to learn any more about this. I've really had it. I think if I learned any more, my brain would just pop open. I'm going to look at the eye instead. Maybe we can understand that better. Here it is. What a wonderful piece of equipment the eye is. Man can get so proud and boastful. But you know what I think about? So far, man's best efforts at a total eyeball replacement is known as a glass eye. Not quite up to original equipment. Now, you may not realize this, but the eye is part of the brain. It's not just attached to the brain. The eye is a part of the brain. So when you look into somebody's eyes through the cornea, see the colored part in the pupil, you're looking at the brain. So you see with your brain. You have a clear window that's as clear as the finest crystal here called the cornea. You get to the edge of the cornea and the tissue continues on, but it's no longer clear there. In fact, it has blood vessels out here. And if you had a tough night, you can see lots of blood vessels out there, can't you? But there are no blood vessels in the cornea. That would really obscure the view, wouldn't it? Then inside this window, you see the part of the brain that is the eye. And so we get this little marvelous combination. The cornea is part of the skin of the body. If you go up the cornea, you go right under the eyelid, down the inside of the eyelid, out the outside of the eyelid, and right up onto your forehead, and it's all one piece all the way, seamless. So the cornea is skin, except this skin is a clear window. Imagine you have a beautifully clear window in your skin, and by an incredible stroke of dumb luck, you just happen to have an eyeball to look through the window. Imagine if you had the eyeball and no window, wouldn't that be grim? What if you had the window and no eyeball? It'd be disgusting. But the two together, this is a godly touch. And it looks through the cornea. And this cornea is more than a window. It's the most important lens in the eye. You have two lenses in the eye. You have the lens, and then you have the cornea. And the cornea is four times more powerful than the lens. You might say, well, why have we got a lens then? Because the lens can change focus, at least while you're young. And the cornea can't change focus. But it is the most important one in terms of bending light. The diaphragm in here opens and closes to automatically adjust the amount of light coming in, just like the diaphragm on an automatic camera. And then right in the middle, we call that the pupil. Now, hey, we call it the pupil in English. It has other names in other languages. And the children of Israel had a different name for the pupil. They called it the apple. I guess they thought it looked like an apple. So in Hebrew, it would be called a term that basically is translated apple. And it's interesting, there are verses in the Bible that mention this apple, and we start to get a little insight here. Have you heard the expression, you're the apple of my eye? Ever wonder where that comes from? It comes from God. He says, we're the apple of his eye. Isn't it wonderful to be the apple of somebody's eye? Grandkids are the apple of their grandparents' eye, or children are the apple of their parents' eye. But think of it, we're the apple of God's eye. In fact, it's more beautiful than that because the expression really isn't that you are the apple of my eye. God doesn't really say that. He says, I keep you as the apple of my eye. What does that mean? See, we see that right here. Here's God talking about Israel, which he's led through the desert and everything. And he's referring to Israel, but he really is referring to Christians of all time. It says, he, that is God, encircled him, protected. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. The word keep here would be better perhaps translated protect. God protected him as the apple of the eye. Now, what does this mean? You see, what God is telling us, and everybody knew even at this time, that it really doesn't feel great to have a sharp stick in the eye. You can imagine people would have learned that quick. That poking people in the eye is not a pleasurable experience. In fact, if anybody gets even near your eyeball, lined with a pupil to poke, what happens? You blink. You can't even keep yourself from blinking. It's a reflex. It's the fastest reflex in the body because it has the shortest fiber track of any other, you know, from your knee. You can practically count to 10. You get to be my age. It has to go all the way up to the spinal cord and back again, see? But on the eye, it's a little short track, and bang, it's instant. In fact, this blink reflex is the last reflex to be lost when you die. Emergency medical technicians coming upon somebody who's deeply comatose and may in fact be gone will touch the cornea of the eye with something, and if there's no blink, they're probably gone. Now, we can understand the imagery that God gives us. He says he protects us the way we protect the cornea of our eye right over the pupil. It's instantaneous. It's reflexive. It's to the death, indeed the death of Jesus. Now, it's mentioned three places in the Bible, and they're all just really worth your study. This is in Deuteronomy 32. If God says he does that for us, then what ought we to do? We ought to pray that he would indeed do that for us. And the psalmist has done that. Psalm 17:8. Lord, keep me, remember, protect me as the apple of your eye. Hide me in the shadow of your wings. Now, what are we waiting on? A response from God. Will he do this? Beautiful passage. Zechariah 2:8. For thus says the Lord. This is all capital level. L-O-R-D. The great Jehovah God. Unspeakable word to the Jews. I mean, couldn't even be pronounced. This is the highest name for God. For thus says the Lord of hosts, he who touches you touches the apple of his, that is God's eye. What God is saying, anyone that troubles you, anyone that persecutes you is poking him in the eye. What an incredible concept. And you didn't think there was that much theology in the eye, did you? It's a piece of anatomy. We can learn from everything. God uses these examples. He wants us to consider these things. He instructs us in this way. Now the world has a different view. This is Frank Zindler. He's like me. He's a retired university professor. And he has a website, and he hates creation. He hates creationists. He knows that there's not the slightest trace of design in the human eye. And if you look on his website, and I don't recommend it, he says, although the human eye would be a scandal if it were the result of divine deliberation, a plausible evolutionary explanation of its absurd construction can be obtained quite easily. Stripped of academic blather, what is he saying? He says, you know, if there was a God that had anything to do with the eye, it would be a scandal because it's such an absolutely dreadful piece of trash that any God taking credit for it would be just discrediting himself. He says, but given that it's a piece of junk, this is completely consistent with what you'd expect from evolution because, after all, evolution isn't designing anything, right? There is no intelligent design in evolution. Everything's chaos, just random change and differential reproduction. That's it. You expect junk from evolution. And he says, the eye is junk, which proves there is no God, because if a God would have made this junk, he'd be embarrassed. but evolution makes junk. How on earth can be? How can someone be a scientist with this kind of a view? And what on earth is he getting at? What displeases him about the eye? I'll give you a little advance notice. He thinks the retina, the part that's sensitive to light, is in the eye upside down. In fact, almost all the biology books will tell you. That's what public schools are all about in colleges. They tell you that God doesn't know what he's doing. If he existed, he got the film and the camera upside down. Can you imagine such a God? I mean, even we know how to get the film in properly. Now, Darwin was a little troubled by the eye. In his Origin of Species, he said, and I quote, "To suppose that the eye, with all of its devices for adjusting the focus to different distances and for different permitting different amounts of light and for the correction of different aberrations and what have you, optical aberrations, that this could have been formed by natural selection seems, I confess, get this, absurd in the highest degree." Notice Darwin didn't say that the chance evolution of the eye was absurd. If that's all he said, I wouldn't have even brought it up. He said, it's as absurd as it gets. That's absurd, right? They're just plain absurd, and then they're as absurd as it's possible to be absurd. And that's what Darwin's talking about. Now, does this mean he didn't believe that the eye evolved by chance? Oh, no, he went on then and said it evolved by chance. Just wanted you to know that it was absurd as it gets. Now, if you really want to know something about the eye, I can think of nothing better other than God's Word to talk to Mr. Eye. If we have any ophthalmologists here, I don't think there would be any great disagreement that probably the Mr. Eye, if we're going to pick one person in the whole area of ophthalmology who's been as influential as anybody on earth, it would be the late, great Sir Stuart Duke Elder, who was knighted for his work on the eye. He was the author of a very large set of books, I think 14 or 15 volumes, was basically an encyclopedia on the eye. He authored many other books on the eye. He was at London Medical School. And in this massive series of books on the eye that you'll see in a medical school, almost nowhere else, or a department of ophthalmology, the first book in the series, you have one, you know, dealing with the first with evolution, then the anatomy, then the physiology, then the pathology, and then the surgery, and on and on and on it goes. And the first one is called The Eye in Evolution. So Duke Elder was an evolutionist. And he is talking about the evolution of the eye. And look what he has to say. "It would seem, therefore, that despite the considerable amount of thought expended on the question of the evolution of the eye, the emergence of the vertebrate eye with its inverted retina of neural origin and its elaborate dioptic mechanism derived from the surface ectoderm is what? The evolution is a problem as yet unsolved." Now, if that's all he said, I wouldn't have even brought it up, but he goes further than that. He says on page 247 of this book, dealing with the evolution of the eye, that indeed the eye, appearing as it does, fully formed in the most primitive species of animals existing today, and all in the absence of transition forms, that is anything you'd see in the fossil record showing how one thing evolved into the next by stages. He says, and in the absence of transition forms with which it can be associated, and I love this, unless by speculative hypothesis with little factual foundation, he says, if you'd rather avoid that, then there seems little likelihood of finding a satisfactory and pragmatic solution to the puzzle presented by its evolutionary development. Let's summarize the two points he has made. Point number one, we know nothing about the evolution of the eye. Point number two, he doesn't think we ever will. Now, did I fail to mention that this book is 843 pages long, dealing with the evolution of the eye? Now, I'm a pretty long-winded guy, as you know. It takes me a half hour to get my name and address. But if I wrote a book on the evolution of the eye, and if I had come to the conclusion that we knew nothing about the subject and never would know anything about the subject, I think I could have gotten this across in 600 or 700 pages. I wouldn't have needed 843 pages to say that. You know, and evolutionists say, well, if you look at the simple eyes evolved into the more complicated ones. Well, my goodness, the eyes like we have are even found in invertebrates. The octopus has an eye pretty much like we do, the same basic design. And it's an invertebrate. There are other invertebrates that have really bizarre eyes, like the trilobites. You've heard of them. They're supposed to become extinct very early in evolution, right after the Cambrian explosion. And they have compound eyes, like you see in insects. And there are several different kinds of trilobites, and some of them don't have eyes at all. But their eyes are really complicated. The lens, they look like a big roly-poly. They range in size from a little thing to about yay big. They look like roly-polies. They think they're extinct, although I wouldn't be surprised if we found one alive today in the bottom of the ocean someplace, the same way we found the coelacanth, thinking it was gone for 80 million years. But here's what's amazing. The lens of the trilobite is composed of prismatic calcite. What this means is that in most of these species of trilobites, the lens is essentially a very fine quality optical glass. Now, glass doesn't rot. Glass is permanent. So when you dig up a trilobite, its whole body may have been replaced by stone, but the lens in the eye is pretty much the same lens this rascal had when it was alive. They've actually popped these lenses out and looked at them with a microscope, looked right through. They find out that on some of these trilobites, it's in focus from 1 millimeter, the thickness of a dime, out to infinity without having to adjust anything. But if that's all the more amazing their lenses were, I wouldn't have even brought it up. But it's more amazing than that. Let's look at this rascal here. It's a trilobite coming at you. Here's all those, see the little separate eyes with their own lenses here and here? Let's crank up the power. This is one lens. Here's another. And these are a very fine grade of optical glass, prismatic calcite, all perpendicular to the surface. But here's what's amazing. Here are two different species of trilobites. They've looked at the lenses, and they find that the lens of this trilobite and the lens of the other is actually made of two different types of optical glass cemented together the way we make highly corrected optics for microscopes and telescopes. And the way you grind the two and the way they are cemented together and the differences in the glass give you highly corrected lenses. Are you ready for this? The great physicist Descartes designed what he considered to be the perfect lens for a certain application, and it turns out that this species of the trilobite has Descartes' lens. This trilobite happens to have the very lens designed by the great Huygens, which was considered to be a perfectly corrected lens. Two trilobites that say, we'll meet you and raise you one, to all of the great physicists. It took a great physicist to design these lenses, and yet the evolutionist says, dumb luck. Chance. Well, when the eye develops, and I'm not talking about evolution, I'm talking embryology, okay, the baby in the womb. I told you it's part of the brain. This is the brain over here. You have to think of it as being a big empty thing. It's got a big ventricle inside, especially here. And this little hollow bud comes off the brain in the front part of the brain, near the front of the head. And it's hollow, and the little hollow ball gets pushed in. Think of a basketball. It doesn't have much air in it. You can kind of push it in. It makes it kind of a cup, wouldn't it? A double wall cup. And the inner wall is going to be the retina, the light-sensitive part of the eye. The outer wall back here is going to form what we call the choroid of the eye. It's full of blood vessels and has pigment in it. And these two layers, which were separate, get cemented together. And when the Lord cemented them together originally, he cemented them to stay that way because everything was perfect that he created. But after the fall into sin, the cement breaks down, these layers separate, and that's called a detached retina. It really is opening up a condition that was there in the embryo. That's part of the fall. That's not the way God designed it. The other part of the eye doesn't have anything to do with the brain. That's the lens and the cornea. That comes from basically skin. So the two together make an eye. One or the other by itself wouldn't be that much use. Well, let's look at the eye now. This is a fully developed eye, a picture. We're just looking at the front quarter. This is the cornea. This is the sclera that has the blood vessels in it. This is the iris diaphragm opening and closing. Here's the lens. The lens is suspended by little strings in three-dimensional space. And it's under tension, which keeps the lens real flat, because the lens is like rubber. It's as clear as glass, but it's rubbery. And it's held by its equator under tension, and that makes the lens kind of flat. But, excuse me, when these muscles contract out here, that puts slack in those little attachment fibers, and then the lens just naturally rounds up when you put slack in it. But when it's under tension, it's flat. When it's flat, you're looking at a distance. When it's rounder, you're looking up close. So it's all automatic focus. Hey, the Lord didn't have to do it that way. He could have made your eyes just like binoculars. You know how the binoculars are made? I can imagine that if God would have made our eyes like binoculars, he would have put a roller right here on our nose, right, to focus with, like you do in binoculars. Everywhere you look, you just do this. Imagine driving down the road, focusing your eye with one hand, cell phone with the other, it'd be a mess. But the Lord gave us autofocus. And you know, when you autofocus a camera, you actually adjust the lens forward and back. But the Lord says, it's too simple. I want something fast. Actually changes the shape of the lens so that it's actually a different lens for the different focusing points. Fluid is produced here. The fluid comes out, fills the eye with fluid, and there's a little pump, and the pump pumps it up because it has to be pumped up to a certain pressure, about 11, 12 millimeters of mercury pressure. And the reason it has to be under pressure is for the eye to focus properly and be sharp, everything has to be physically the right shape, right? You can't have any dents or wiggles or anything in it. And so the eye is made up of some really inelastic stuff that's very tough. And when it pumps up, it's like a ball. It gets to a certain shape and size, and it stays there. But if you keep on pumping, which it does, it pumps and pumps and pumps and pumps, and poof, you can blow the thing out, right? Lord's aware of the problem. So there's a little check valve here. It goes all the way around between the cornea and the diaphragm, and I love the name of it. That's the only reason I'm bringing it up. It's called the Canal of Schlemm. And this has little trap doors that apparently open and close and allow the fluid to escape to go into these little vessels that carry really not so much blood as water. They're called the water veins or aqueous veins. And so by constantly producing more fluid and by controlling this check valve, you keep the pressure just right in the eye. But if the check valve gets contaminated or something's damaged and the pressure starts building, we call that glaucoma. You can become blind. But normally, before the fall into sin, this check valve never fails. And but you have to have a certain amount of pressure, not too much, and it's got to all be automatic because it'd be disgusting if we had to put a pump up there and pump up the eye. We'd ruin it anyway, wouldn't we? Let's look at the lens. The cells that make up the lens live on the front. They look like pavement stones right on the front surface. As they divide these cells, they slide around the front to the edge, the equator. When they get to the edge, they're like that little red dot there. They turn into the lens, and when they turn into the lens, they become real long, like a filament. In fact, if you look at these lines up here, each of these lines might represent one cell. It starts out like this dot. One end goes all the way up to here to the center. The other one comes all the way around here to the center. And we call those the lens fibers. They're actually a lens cell. Let's take a look at that lens in the microscope. We're going to look at this edge right here. Okay, here's the lens from a human. Here are the cells. They look like little boxcars coming down to the edge. And right here you see they turn in. Notice they don't go back here. They turn in. And when they do, see these lines? Those are those long cells that go halfway around the lens. And then the nucleus breaks down, and the cell no longer has a nucleus, and it becomes a permanent part of your eye for life. It's never replaced. And it's all supposed to stay rubbery, which it did before the fall, but after the fall, you get to be, what, 30, 40 years old or so, and it quits focusing. Mine doesn't focus anymore. And if we take this lens and we dry it, and we hit it with a hammer and break it open and put it in the scanning electron microscope, we can see these cells. You will know there is a creator now for sure. These are the lenses of the individual cells of the lens, just broken open. They would be these things here, just randomly broken. You can see they're in there stacked, absolutely perfect and register like lumber in a lumberyard, except no lumberyard stacks their boards quite that neatly. Each of these is a lens fiber or a lens prism or a lens cell. And if we crank up the power, we find out what holds them in such beautiful register. Thousands and thousands of peg and socket interlocking devices hold all these cells in perfect register. The interior, this is one cell from here to here, and of course very long, is absolutely stuffed full of a protein called crystalline because it's as clear as the finest crystal. And it's the most protein-rich cell in the body. And it has just perfect optical properties to function as a magnificent lens, as fine as the finest optical glass, but flexible, so it can change focus. Well, let's get back to the retina. This is where the evolutionists say, trash, where's your God? Can't even get the film and the camera right. You see, the retina is like the film and the camera. It's as thin as a piece of tissue paper. It looks like it's thick here in the orange, but it's really pretty thin. And this is a picture I took through the microscope of the layers in the retina. And these are ganglion cells, just like you'd see in the brain, not like you see in the peripheral nervous system. These are brain ganglion cells, and these are the fiber tracts from these ganglion cells that go off to the brain through the optic tract. The light comes in from the top up here, goes through all these ganglion cells to get all the way down here, and it's this last row at the bottom that are the light-sensitive cells called the photoreceptors, and it's the ends of these cells called the rods and cones that are actually sensitive to light. Now, this is where the evolutionist says, where's your God? The light comes from here, has to go through all this stuff, doesn't hit a photosensitive cell till it's down here, obviously. If this God was worth anything at all, he would have switched this around and put the light-sensitive cells up here. But no, he puts it down here, which according to evolutionists proves there is no God. On the other hand, it proves evolution because you expect evolution to do things really poorly. Now tell me, if you believe this, would you be inclined to study why the retina appears to be upside down? No, because you already know. There is no God. It wasn't designed. Evolution does these disastrous things. So you would have no reason to study it. You'd just say you expect that from evolution. But what if you didn't believe in evolution? What if you're a Bible-believing Christian? Then what would you say? Wow, this is interesting. I'll bet there's a good reason. Wouldn't you say that? And if you did, you'd be onto something. Because retinal physiologists can write books on why this is just optimum. There is one group of animals that does have their retina up here, and that's the octopus. The octopus has the right side up retina, according to evolutionists. All vertebrates, animals with bones, have the upside down. So an eagle is upside down, an octopus is right side up. Now let's compare the two. You get an eagle along the Mississippi River there between Illinois and St. Louis, a certain time of the year, the eagles come in, and they set up in the trees, and it said that they can see a fish just under the surface of the water up to a mile away. Now, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to get an octopus. Take them up in the tree, set them on the limb, aim them towards the river, and say, check it out. What do you think? I don't think he would see anything. I think there's a good reason why we call sharp-eyed people eagle-eyed and not octopus-eyed. But according to evolutionists, the octopus should have all the advantages. Now, hey, I agree. The octopus is probably much better looking underwater where it lives than the eagle would underwater. But there are many reasons why we're in this configuration. First of all, let me say it doesn't seem to hurt anything. What are the two things you might gain if you built it better? It might be, what, more sensitive to light? How sensitive is the vertebrate retina to light? We know from neurophysiological experiments that these cells can respond to single photons of light. That's as good as it gets. It is responsive to light over a range of 10 billion to 1. That's one photon to a sun-drenched snowscape. You might say, well, you'd see sharper if it were up there, right? A better resolution? How good is the resolution of the vertebrate retina? It is so good that it's better than the lens and cornea. So an ophthalmologist will tell you that the eye is what we call refraction limited. It's limited by its optics, not by its retina. That's why people say, should we teach creation in the public school? I say, no, I'd be content if we ever got around to teaching science in the public schools. Right. Teach what I'm talking about here. Why not? You think students would enjoy this? Post-Dispatch said they talk about creation, it's boring. You know, I don't know, am I talking about creation? I hope it's not boring. Now, one of the reasons why it's good to be down here, there's several. One is, these are the most metabolically active cells in the body. They have a higher demand for oxygen and nutrients than any other cell in the body. They are hauling so fast that they turn over about every 10 days. They have to be replaced, at least the outer segments. And when they're replaced, there have to be cells to eat up the discarded cell parts and allow new ones to be built. And you wouldn't want those cells crawling around in view of the top up here, so they're down in the bottom. Because of the high metabolic demands, these cells must be tucked right into the richest blood supply in the body. The richest blood supply by far is the choroid. It's essentially a lake of blood. It's not even like separate blood vessels. It's an intersecting net of blood. If you were going to take these cells and bring them up here, you'd have to bring this blood supply with them. Forget about looking through that. Solid lake of blood. The other thing is when a photon comes down and hits the cell, the next thing that must happen to that photon is it must hit a pigment layer that absorbs it. Because if it didn't, if the cells were up here, the photon would hit once, fire the photoreceptor, go down, bounce off other cells, come back and hit it a second time, and that would burn out the retina. Now, believe me, you talk to an ophthalmologist, they can go on for a week telling you why this is optimum. But you read a biology textbook and they say this is all trash. Are you beginning to see something? Not only is evolution some really bad theology or religion, evolution is bad science. From a purely secular point of view, it is bad science. But then let's look at Richard Dawkins. Remember Richard Dawkins? He's the atheist that wrote The Blind Watchmaker. You can just hear him drip. Any engineer would naturally assume that the photocells would point towards the light with their wires leading backwards towards the brain. He would laugh at any suggestion that the photocells might point away from the light. I'm sorry, Dawkins, never mind, he's at Oxford, he's clueless when it comes to neurophysiology of the retina. He is simply clueless. He should talk to any ophthalmologist, they'd put him straight in no time at all. Here's another thing. Here are those photoreceptors we're talking about. This is that lake of blood I was talking about. 95% of the blood to the retina is here. Where is the other 5%? Up on top. This is a sandwich, a blood vessel, but 5% on top, 95% on the bottom. That means you still have to look through 5%. And the brain can filter out that 5%. It wouldn't even be able to see through these. Now, even how it filters out the 5% is incredible. Wait till you see this. When an ophthalmologist or a physician looks in your eye with a little scope, right, and they peek in there, you ever wonder what they see? This is it. They look inside, and they see these retinal blood vessels, that 5% that's on the top. And you have to look through these. So basically, your retina is like this sheet of paper. And my fingers are the 5% vessels on top, the retinal blood vessels, and you're looking right through them. They're in your way, but you're looking right through them. You say, well, wait a minute, how come I don't see them? Because they're casting a shadow on your retina. Oh, this is neat. The brain has a little rule. The rule is, if it doesn't move, ignore it. That's a little program that's built into the brain. So the shadow of these blood vessels in your retina does not move. If you move your eye, notice they go along for the ride. So they never move. So you don't see your own retinal blood vessels. You say, well, wait a minute. You can see this microphone. It's not moving. How come you can see that? Oh, this is neat. The muscles to your eyeball cause it to tremor at a high frequency, constantly, like this. So your retina is doing this. Everything you see is moving on your retina. If the muscles to your eye became paralyzed and the eye didn't move, you couldn't see things unless you moved your head like this. So You can't see your own retinal vessels. They're right there. Now, there's a little experiment you can do where you can see your own retinal blood vessels. What would we have to do to see our own retinal blood vessels? We'd have to cause that shadow to move. If we can get light really close up here and then do this with the light, the shadow will just move enough that you can see your own retinal blood vessels. Now, I'm going to give each of you a chance to see your own retinal blood vessels. This next slide, everybody tells me, of all the pictures I show, this is the most interesting. Going the wrong way. This is the most interesting, this slide right here. And you think, wait a minute, what's so interesting about that? Wait till you see, you'll agree. First, we have to get light up close to our eye, but you don't have any little pen lights to do this. You could do it with a pen light. What you can do instead is make a little tiny hole, the smallest hole you can make with your finger. Do not do this. It's got to be the littlest hole you can make and still look through. You put that little hole in front of one of your two eyes, close the other eye, look through the little hole. Now, one final thing you have to do. You have to make the little hole go left and right about an inch or two real fast, like da-da-da-da-da-da, like that. Not like this. Left and right while looking through the hole at the screen. And that'll cause the shadow of your retinal vessels to move, and each of you that tries this will see your own retinal vessels appear on the screen as little grayish silver lines. How many people can see that here? Yeah, as for the rest of you, what can I say? Blind as bats. Okay. So that's how the eye is able to filter out those vessels. Now, what about the muscles that move the eye? Here's the eyeball in its socket. There's a muscle on the top, a muscle on the bottom. Here you can see it over here, one on the top, one on the bottom. One towards the nose, one away from the nose. When these muscles contract, they make the eyeball look up, right? Down. And then on the sides, like reins on a horse, the eyeball looks towards the nose and away from the nose. That makes sense? Up, down, left, and right. But there's more than four muscles to each eye. There are six. What are the other two? Oh, this is neat. You'll love it. The other two go crossways. They go crossways. This one doesn't even fit. It doesn't fit crossways. It actually runs longitudinally down the orbit of the eye, but its tendon goes through the most magnificent little lubricated pulley you have ever seen. You need a hand lens to see it. When we dissect human cadavers, when we get to that little pulley, it's called a trochlea, I bring in a little lens and have the students look at it. It's tiny and it's so gorgeous. This little tendon like a hair goes through there, makes a tighter than 90-degree angle, goes across the eye. On the bottom, the muscle fits. But what the net result is, this is a nose over here. This is the eyeball for the left eye looking at you. The two muscles are like this, and they pull like this, and what they do is rotate the eye. Isn't this great? Your eyeballs do this. Why do they do that? Is that so junior high school boys can gross out the girls in class? No, you see, you have voluntary control of the up, down, left, and right. You can do that yourself, right? But the muscles that do this, the Lord knew better than to leave those up to you, because what they're doing is keeping your horizon level as your head tilts. So even as you walk, I don't know if you've seen the way we academics walk, but it's sort of like this. And the eyeballs automatically rotate to stay right side up. And afterwards, you can get together with somebody, you can do a little experiment. You can look deeply into their eyes. We've had some wonderful relationships grow out of this. And you look at a little spot like on the cornea, or I'm sorry, on the sclera or on the colored part of the eye. When you see some little marker, have them tilt their head and you'll see the eye will rotate to stay right side up. Now, don't stand on your head because it won't do a 180, but it will go shoulder to shoulder. And if the eyeballs do not move left, right, up, down, and rotate, in absolute synchrony, you see double. So everywhere you look, the two eyes have to... It's like two-gun Pete. Every time he drew and shot, the two bullets made one hole. That's some shooting, right? Your eyes are doing that all the time. If they weren't, if they're off by a degree or two, you'd see double. And it's all automatic. Well, I can see some eyelids beginning to droop on me, so we should talk about those too. Inside the eyelids, a little plate that stiffens it. The lower eyelid doesn't move much. The upper one does most of the moving. And there's a little muscle, see it right here, that raises the eyelid. that sphincter one closes it, and this one opens it. And this is skeletal muscle. That's why you can blink at folks whenever you want to, right? But think of that. Skeletal muscle has one advantage, and that is it's under voluntary control. It has a disadvantage, and what is it? If I sit here and look all day, what's going to happen? Muscle's going to fatigue, and the eyelid's going down. The Lord's aware of the problem. There is a magnificent muscle inserted in tandem right here called the muscle of Mueller. This is smooth muscle like you have in the uterus or the intestinal tract. You don't have voluntary control over it, but it can set and contract all day without getting tired. So you have one little snip of muscle to hold your eyelid up over the long haul, and then a separate voluntary one so you can go around winking and blinking at people. The Lord thinks of everything. And then, if you look in your eyelids right towards your nose, there's two little holes in the eyelid towards the nose, and there's a little pump in there that sucks fluid off the eye, because you see out here in your eye on each side is a little window washer that produces tear fluid that's absolutely perfect, the perfect pH, the perfect salinity. It even has special proteins and enzymes to kill bacteria. That's what causes the matty, you know, when you get grit in your eye, it's the evaporation of water leaving the protein behind. And this water is constantly flowing from the edge of the eye towards the nose, and these two little pumps, one in each lid, just keep sucking the water off, keeps the water flowing, keeps the surface of the eye washed and bathed, but most importantly, it leaves a film of water on the cornea that is absolutely smooth as water is smooth. If you didn't have the water, the cornea itself is rough, and it would scatter the light, and you wouldn't see as well. But by having the water layer, it's a perfect interface. But you got to be careful. If the water layer gets too thick, it behaves like a lens. Then it gets blurry. That's why when you start tearing up, it gets blurry. You get too much water, it gets blurry. So the pump has to pump at just the right rate to keep the water layer just right, to keep the water from going over the edge of the lid. There are glands that make oil along the edge. And so the water goes up to the oil dam and doesn't go any further. Normally, this all works. The water keeps going. Oil lid keeps it from going over the edge. But if you start producing a lot of tear fluid, here's what happens. When the water is pulled off the eye by the two little suckers, it goes into a tube that goes down into your nose, which explains why you get the sniffles when you cry, because the tear fluid is going into the nose. If you produce more fluid yet, faster than what the little pump can pump it off, then the layer gets thick and you get blurry-eyed. And then if you produce more water yet, it gets so thick it breaks over the dam and it comes down the cheeks. And I think that's a good place to end, because Revelations 21, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things have passed away. Well, that particular talk is available, and it's called A Hearing Ear and the Seeing Eye, and it's out there if you're interested. So many good books, so many resources available for you. You'd be missing out if you didn't get a magazine subscription to Answers Magazine, and a few books for grandkids, and it would kind of support EIG too, because we make a small profit off the books as well. And I just want to thank you for being such a wonderfully attentive audience, and if you've enjoyed things so far, tomorrow morning I promise a capper. The Chancer design, I'm just going to go around into some of the most amazing things I've seen, including I'm going to talk about a single hair. It is so complicated, you will beg me to stop, and it's one hair. And we'll just talk about what's the probability you could do this by chance. We get into numbers like you can't even imagine. One chance in numbers that just simply even aren't used because they're so big. And we'll see that the evidence for a creator God is so overwhelming that even apart from his word, we'd intuitively know it. Indeed, the Lord holds us without excuse on the judgment day, if for no other reason than we fail to see that he is, in fact, the great creator God. So that's tomorrow, and then tomorrow I also give the lecture on Fearfully and Wonderfully Made, the development of the baby in the Womb, which I guess is kind of a favorite these days. It's, I think, one of the top-selling DVD at AIG, and a lot of the pro-life community are interested in that, and we have that available, too. Other than that, I thank you. You've been very kind and attentive. Thank you.